Thanks very much, Bill. I can't imagine a better time to have a world-class political analyst such as Michael Barone speak to the Forum Club. Over the past 5 years, the country has undergone a major shift in direction, and the next two elections are going to determine whether we continue on that path or we reverse course. Meanwhile, both the Republicans and the Democrats have resumed the tedious but important task of jacking up the federal deficit. In the House of Representatives, Republicans want concessions to raise the debt ceiling. They're waiting for Nancy Pelosi to blink. I'm not certain anatomically that that's possible. So there may be a long wait, but fortunately for us, we have Michael Barone to sort it all out. Michael is the senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner, a prolific award-winning author, contributor to Fox News. I'm not going to repeat his impressive bio, except to mention that Michael's biennial almanac of American politics is quite simply the gold standard, nearly 2,000 pages that everyone connected with politics has to have on their reference shelves. Michael's interest in political statistics began 64 years ago with the 1950 census numbers in the World Book Encyclopedia. Instead of playing in his backyard, Michael would sneak down to the basement to make tables showing the population of major cities. And interestingly, Detroit, where Michael grew up, had 1,850,000 people at the time. And now, 64 years later, Motown has become less town. Detroit's population is now roughly 700,000, a 62% decline. The only thing that grew, apparently, was the crime rate. And sadly, the students, the high school kids in Detroit, spend their freshman year in civics studying their Miranda rights. In fact, Detroit was the impetus for Michael's move from political liberal to political conservative. He blames so-called progressive policies for turning Detroit into a bankrupt shadow of its former self. After the 1960 election, Michael decided to color code his Rand McNally Atlas to reflect the Kennedy-Nixon outcome in all 3,141 U.S. counties, and he has been crunching election statistics ever since, even though I have warned him that 82.7% of all statistics are made up on the spot. Over the years, Michael has traveled to 51 countries, all 50 states, and every one of our 435 congressional districts. He is America's most comprehensive resource for election demographics and commentary. Please join me in welcoming to the Forum Club, Michael Barone.
Oh, that's right. Well, thank you, Bob, and thank you, fellow census lovers, for that warm welcome today. Bob is correct. I was counted as one of the 1,849,568 people in the city of Detroit in April 1, 1950. April 1st, 2010, it was down to 713,777. So we're going to go on at that for about 45 minutes here with those numbers. But those numbers do tell you a story. I mean, and one of the things that I found over the years is that as a kid, I learned the numbers, and they were kind of fun. But the numbers are clues to human reality, to the lives and hopes and ambitions and flaws of human beings, of fellow Americans. And it's something that I've been trying to learn for a long time. I was in the polling business for a few years and with Peter Hart, a Democratic polling firm, back when I was a liberal. And I've changed to become a conservative. And people sometimes ask me the reason why. My one-word answer is Detroit. We tried that stuff, and it didn't work out so good. But as a recovering pollster, I thought I'd start off now by asking a polling question of the audience. And I'd like you to, the polling question is, what is your favorite cable news channel? And I'd like to raise your hand if your favorite cable news channel is MSNBC. Okay, we've got some Chris Matthews fans here. I've known Chris Matthews for more than 30 years, and one thing you have to say, give Barack Obama. He is the first male to send a tingle up Chris Matthews' leg. And let's have the hands for CNN. How many are CNN watchers here? Ah, okay, we've got a fair number of CNN people here. And, you know, it's actually a very tragic thing happened to CNN recently. Larry King's last viewer died. And we'll continue. Fox News Channel. Do we have any Fox News Channel people here? I can see that we have a fair and balanced audience. In Bob's introduction is helpful to me because he stressed that I like to put things in the historic perspective and not just the population figures for the city of Detroit. And, you know, when you watch a lot of the media today, read a lot of the newspapers, blogs and things, we've been dealing with really important issues like how many lanes are open on the access to the George Washington Bridge. But I like to look in a longer perspective. I mean, back in the 1990s, I used to say we wanted to look back beyond Al D'Amato to Al de Tocqueville. And put the 2014 political climate in a larger perspective. And I'd start off by saying that Barack Obama and the Democratic Party, after their big victory in 2008, made a bet. They bet their political future and the country's policy future on an abstract proposition. And that abstract proposition was that in times of economic distress, Americans would be more supportive of or amenable to big government policies than they would otherwise be. And it's a lesson that they and many others, not just liberals, but some conservatives, moderates as well, took from the New Deal historians of Franklin Roosevelt and the Depression of the 1930s. These historians were gifted writers. Their books were bestsellers in the 1950s and 60s. Some have been bestsellers in more recent years. I think their interpretation of the 1930s is wrong, or at least significantly deficient. I made that argument in my 1990 book, Our Country, The Shaping of America from Roosevelt to Reagan. I found recently looking on Amazon.com that a copy can be obtained for 11 cents. You put a lot of work into writing a book that's 700 pages long. People did, you know, I could go on at length about the difference there, but basically my argument was that Roosevelt received credit in his first congressional and his first re-election election, 1936, for restoring order to an economy that was in a downward deflationary spiral. But that his policies of economic redistribution, whether it was Social Security, the labor union law, higher taxes on high earners, heavy government regulation of business, those policies, which the New Deal historian said were responsible for his winning four presidential elections, were in fact quite unpopular when people began to see how they were working out in practice. You read the history of the second Roosevelt term and the New Deal coalition lost its congressional majorities, never really retained them. Roosevelt won his third and fourth terms in 1940 and 1944 as a leader in a time of world war and world catastrophe. In 1940, Hitler and Stalin were in allies. They were threatening to take over the landmass of Eurasia. This was a moment of emergency, and I argued that actually Americans, even in times of economic distress, aren't so fond of policies of economic redistribution, and they are particularly unfond of them when they see how they work out in practice. And I think we're seeing something like that today. We saw the Obama Democrats pass the $787 billion stimulus bill. the increased spending on things like food stamps, the disability insurance, and so forth. The effects on the economy have not been very positive. We've had the most sluggish economic growth in a period of supposed economic recovery that has happened certainly since the 1930s. And that has, if you ask Americans today in polls, are we still in a recession? Majority say yes. Well, you know, the economist of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which does the definitive work on this, says the recession ended in June 2009. That's nearly 4 years, 5 years ago. But people think we're still in it, and they have some reason to do so. And they passed the Obamacare bill. They took advantage of temporary breaks that gave them 60-vote supermajority in the Senate. They persevered, even though polling showed consistent opposition. They proceeded, even though the American people, speaking through the unlikely medium of the voters of the Commonwealth in Massachusetts, said, please don't pass this law. They passed it nevertheless. Speaker Nancy Pelosi assured us that we would understand what was in the legislation after it was passed. Well, here we are. The Democrats did not pay a huge price in the 2012 election. The president was reelected with 51% of the popular vote. He was, by the way, the first American president reelected with a reduced percentage of the popular vote. That's never happened before. In the past, when the popular vote percentage went down, they lost. This did not happen in this case. Republicans maintained their majority in the House, and we've had a continuing series of confrontations, and we've had various arguments over the budget. We've had, I could go through some of the details, but I think most of you have been following this to some extent. One of the things, we've had divided government, where one party has the presidency and another party has a majority in one or both houses of Congress. We, in fact, have had divided government for two-thirds of the time since 1968, the last 45 years. It is more the normal than the abnormal condition in American politics. And one of the things that's resulted is that government spending has been held down. Despite that, and despite the claims of many Keynesian economists, the economy has actually been doing a little better than it was doing in that period of government stimulus, in any case. But I think the biggest event of the year in policy was the Obamacare rollout. Nobody, I think, not even conservative critics, expected it would go so badly. I didn't dare write and predict that it would go as badly as it did. I'm getting email messages from people that were familiar with software programs and how you do that for mass enrollment. I got testimony from various people, but I didn't think so. The Obama administration had 42 months to construct the healthcare.gov website and to put into action Obamacare. By way of comparison, historically, 42 months is the length of time between Pearl Harbor and VE Day. VE Day for the high school students is Victory in Europe Day, May 8, 1945, when Germany surrendered and the United States and its allies were victorious in the European theater of World War II. The United States and American people and the United States government got a lot accomplished in that 42 months. They did some pretty amazing things. They produced an army of 16 million people were enrolled at one time or another in a country of 131 million. Equivalent today would be a military of 38 million, something that's really unthinkable. They put that together. They got war production done very much in excess of what anybody had predicted was possible, supplying not only ourselves but our allies around the world. That was all accomplished in 42 months, and I would give some credit here. Here in Naples, Florida, some people might not like to hear this. President Roosevelt because they had pin-up dolls of Roosevelt in their house when they were growing up. You know, they'd stick pins in it. But he was very good at a number of things, and one of them was picking the right person for the right job, picking the right people who could really accomplish things that seemed to be difficult to accomplish. Picking Eisenhower for D-Day, where you had to command a vast number of troops and be diplomatic between the military leaders of the different powers. Picking a leader like General MacArthur for the Pacific Theater, where the main role was theatrical. And MacArthur was a great dramatic figure. And Roosevelt was he picked the people that built the Pentagon. They built the Pentagon, by the way, in 18 months. It's still the world's largest office building. Compare the Obamacare website. 42 months. They've just sacked the Canadian software firm that they hired. We won't let Canadian oil in through the Keystone Pipeline, but we will let Canadian software in here to design healthcare.gov. I don't think Roosevelt would have chosen the wrong Canadians to advance his policy. But I think this process that we've seen has been pretty profound and pretty important. I think that the rollout of Obamacare has done much to discredit the concept of big government generally. I think if the prestige of big government and of big units, big government, big business, big labor, was hugely enhanced by the success of leaving the Depression, winning World War II, post-war prosperity, which nobody expected, if that gave big government credibility and prestige, the Obamacare rollout, something that's not just something in the newspaper, but something that's affecting individual people in every community in all 435 congressional districts and 3,141 counties and county equivalents across the nation. I think that is a pretty profound thing. And it turns out, you can't keep your doctor or your health insurance if you like them, as Obama and Democrats promised dozens of times. And so we've seen the president's job approval sink from 50% for 50-47 on Election Day 2012, which was almost exactly the popular vote, 51-47. To 43-52 disapproval today, with Obamacare numbers being approximately the same. And I think one thing that's important is that the effect that I think this is having on two groups that were crucial to the victory of President Obama and the Obama Democrats in 2008 and the president's reelection in 2012, young voters and Hispanic voters. After those elections, and particularly after 2008, we were told that the Democratic Party was going to be the majority party for the future forever. Well, I'm old enough to have predicted at various times that both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party would be the majority party forever. I've seen those predictions fail. And just like my prediction of President Romney, I'm not prepared to say any party being the majority, but there was a plausible case to be made. Young voters went 66-32 for President Obama in 2008. People 30 and over went only 50-49, and obviously the correct Republican strategy would have been preemptively to have raised the voting age to 35. We'll include people from the two schools in this, not as honorable 35-year-olds, but and he carried Hispanics in 2012, 67-31. You extrapolate straight-line extrapolations out into the future. You know that people born after 1980 are going to be a larger percentage of the electorate in the future than they were in 2008, 2012. You know that Hispanic people, a term made up by the census, the 1970 census, by the way, are going to be a larger percentage of the population, a larger percentage of the electorate in the future. It was natural to think that they were going to be supportive. Well, what's happened? We can see it in the off-year 2013 elections, where Chris Christie carried Hispanics in New Jersey, Republican governor. His number one job description is doing the traffic flow into the GWB. In Virginia, Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican, actually carried voters 18 to 24, according to the exit poll. Interesting. Contrary to the thought. But I think one of the things we've seen is that Hispanics and millennials, we use the term millennial generation for people born after 1980, although during those election polls, were expressing approval of big government in the abstract, have found that big government doesn't work very well for them. We've seen that for young people, they're saddled with college student debt and degrees that don't seem to be producing jobs. Sluggish job creation has hurt young people tremendously. Older people 55 and older, are holding on to their jobs. They're sticking on the lifeboat and they're kicking the raft. The young people off to the side there, and so forth. And you've seen Obamacare specifically has provisions where the young, under 30s, subsidize the older, less healthy people, 50 to 64, the oldest ones in the system, pre-Medicare. It is somehow progressive for young people who, if you look at the Federal Reserve figures, you'll see have negative net worth because they've got more in credit card college debt than they have in financial assets or housing equity. Negative net worth people subsidizing people who are at their peak net worth in their life, who have net worth of $500,000 in the median. This is nonetheless, they're getting zapped and they're starting to realize it. If you look at Hispanics, they have had government program. They didn't get the Spanish language healthcare.gov website up for 2 months, and then it was written in what I am told is Spanglish. They found people that at least in Spanish were not able to use words good, Well, and these are also the people who have been hit most heavily. If you go look at the data on who was getting most mortgages with, subprime mortgages in the period just before the housing price crash, it's a heavy tilt towards Hispanics as a result of government programs which were supported both by Democratic administrations and by the Republican administration, George W. Bush, and said, well, we don't need to have good credit score here. W-2s. We'll give you a mortgage, no money down, and you'll get rich because housing prices always go up. Well, those are the people who got zapped. Look at the 2007 to 10 figures on where bank foreclosures occurred. I estimate one-third of the foreclosures were Hispanics, and these people's dreams were shattered. They were promised something by government. Government didn't deliver. Obamacare promises them something. It's not delivering. They thought those who were immigrants or from background in another country, that we came to the United States, big government promised you something. Big government was going to be reliable. Big government was going to be competent. Big government was going to play by the rules. They found out that big government in the United States works sort of the way big government does in Mexico. Not something that a sensible person would rely upon if you didn't have connections and were not beneficiaries of crony capitalism. I think that we've seen Gallup showed that the biggest decline in support for approval for the president between November 2012 and November 2007, Hispanics, young people. They're now supporting him by about the national average instead of 9 to 13 points more. That makes those straight-line extrapolations from the 2008 election figures look a little more uncertain. I'm looking ahead to the elections. That's the general background that I think we're in. And I think where opinion is, that the effect of Obamacare in particular has been pretty profound. You will hear the president try to shift the discussion to income inequality and what we're going to do about it. It's my argument that I made in one of my columns in the Washington Examiner recently that the solutions that he proposes are pretty pathetically inadequate to address what problem may exist. Raising the minimum wage is not going to affect things very much. Continuing to extend unemployment insurance, to some extent it's a disincentive to job seeking, which hurts people who are long-term unemployed. There's North Carolina cut its unemployment period and seems to have had an increase in jobs and a decrease in unemployment. There's some ambiguity in the data, and I'm not prepared to say that that's an absolute policy success, but they're not, you know, we're going to have higher taxes on high earners. It turns out that if you take Bill Gates' money all away, it doesn't actually do very much for this gap. And I think that it's an attempt to distract attention from the big government failure of Obamacare. I don't think it's going to work out. 2014 and 2016 obviously are two election cycles. I think the chances for Republicans to do well in 2014 is very much there. You know, if you look at, we've got a kind of a balance in our political system. In a period of intense party competition, and in a period when people are more likely to vote straight ticket voting, we've nonetheless had a difference in the presidential level and the congressional level. Democrats have won four of the last six presidential elections. They carried a plurality of the popular vote in a fifth. Some of you may remember there was a certain amount of litigation here in Florida about that. Republicans have won majorities in the House of Representatives in eight of the last 10 elections. Why have we had this seeming anomaly? Well, I think one major reason is that is demographics. And it's a subject that I'm going to do shameless plug here, addressed in my latest book, Shaping Our Nation, How Surges of Migration Transformed America and Its Politics, which is about migration's internal and immigrant going back to the Scots-Irish in the dozen years before the American Revolution and going up to today's migrations of people where we've had huge immigration from Hispanic and Asian countries, where we've had big internal migrations away from high tax, high housing cost states to low tax, low housing cost states. How many of you here in this room ever lived in New York? Okay, Illinois. New Jersey, which is a high tax state. Okay, I think I made my point. The cumulative result of these has been that Democratic voters, especially groups that have been heavily Democratic, blacks, Hispanics, gentry liberals, my friend Joel Kotkin's term, if you want to know what a gentry liberal is, think of Nancy Pelosi, a rich lady from San Francisco. Tend to be clustered. They tend to live in many central cities, in sympathetic suburbs, and in university towns, and to be relatively scarce outside those communities. And the result is those clusters go very heavily Democratic, 70 to 80 points. They help Democrats win electoral votes and give them an advantage in the Electoral College because they enable them to carry safely states with about 170 electoral votes, only 100 short of the 270 majority. Republicans are spread more evenly around the rest of the country, Republican voters. You won't find too many in Manhattan. You will find a lot in the rest of the country. The result is that in the House of Representatives, Republicans continue to have a big majority, even though people are voting straight ticket. I think that we're going to see the Republicans most likely retain majority in the House. We're going to have serious races in the Senate where Republicans are challenging in seven seats, which Mitt Romney carried in 2007. And there's at least four or five more states which Obama won by small margins, Colorado, Iowa, New Hampshire, Michigan, Virginia, where it looks like Republicans have a very serious chance to win, a good chance for Republicans to get a majority. For the 2016 election, there are still challenges ahead for Republicans. I don't think any of their putative or potential candidates has advanced his position very much, although I don't think any of the Democrats have advanced, any one of them has advanced her or his position very much either. But the fact is that that's a challenge, but I think the perceived failure of Obamacare is going to be one of the defining political and public policy events of the decade. And the events, the ramifications of it, I think we have not yet seen fully. So let me conclude at that point, and we're going to do a little question and answer, I understand.
Michael has his book down beneath here, and of course we have our books. So these are not coloring books, but they are one from Naples and one from Marco Island. We don't have the districts in it so you can color them, but I hope you do enjoy them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for
coming. Thank you. All right. Okay.
Well, we have lots and lots of questions, and we're not possibly going to get through all of them, but let's get a start. What do you think will be the long-term consequences of Harry Reid's having changed the Senate rules regarding confirmation of various appointments by a president?
Well, I think that the likelihood, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, has threatened this, is that if the Republicans get a majority, they're going to change the rules, and it will be more of a majority. They will pass things with 51-vote majorities, like maybe Obamacare repeal, rather than requiring 60, as they have effectively done. Now, there's still a lot of ways, and this is a point McConnell has made, for senators to obstruct proceedings in the Senate, even with Harry Reid's change in the rules, and I don't expect that will go on. I often use the term that one party has control of the House of Representatives. I never use the term one party has control of the Senate.
The next question is, do you think the No Labels group, which is being co-led by former Utah Governor John Huntsman and Joe Manchin, will that group be successful in driving a national strategy that all parties can work toward and creating greater voter participation to drive change?
One word answer, no. I think, it's, I don't doubt the good intentions of people that are behind movements like this, and you say, why can't we just all agree on this set of reasonable propositions, which also usually turn out to be propositions that one side or the other of the political divide actually believes in. President Obama endorses this kind of rhetoric. I'm not partisan or anything, he says, as he goes partisan on one thing after another. Just reasonable people couldn't believe anything different. Our problem is that we've got a country where people do disagree and where you have principled and not crazy disagreement over public policy in large part. We are a country which, over the long run of its history, we have, as the historian Robert Wiebe wrote, we managed to live together because we live apart. We live in our separate little Americas, and there's an increasing tendency to do that. Many people lament this. They point to that period after World War II when you had conformist America, when you had an America where everybody seemed to be average, and you had shared values and faith in big institutions. And a lot of the political science writing on this suggests that this was how America was always like until things went out of hand, last year or 1971 or whenever it was, usually a year or two before they were writing. And I think if you look at the long run of American history, what you will see is that the kind of divisions that we have now are more in the line of the norm than of the exception. They are more the rule. We had a civil war, after all. This country, there's a lot of talk, and I address it in my book, Shaping Our Nation, that we are for the first time a multicultural country. We've always been a homogeneous white bread country, everybody the same. That's just totally wrong. Colonial America was different. You had Cavalier Virginia, Puritan Massachusetts, Quaker Pennsylvania, majority slave South Carolina. And holding them together was a difficult project. They had different religious traditions that people fought wars about religion in Europe. And the founding fathers put up a framework for that. They said there will be no religious test for office, they said in the Constitution. They said that that we would have freedom of religion in the First Amendment, and that we would have Congress will make no law regarding an establishment of religion. Congress, federal government, is just going to be neutral on religion. States could still have established religions, by the way. And that formula has worked. Toleration of differences, limited government, where government doesn't have to decide all these moral issues. People can live them and decide them for themselves and decide them in their states and in their communities and within their own religious churches and other organizations. That has been a winning formula. That has worked mostly for holding together what has always been a multicultural nation.
There's a question here on regarding your position on legalization of recreational marijuana use, suggesting also a broader question. The Republican Party has traditionally been divided into its conservative and libertarian wings. Do you see either wing gaining ascendancy?
One thing I see as I look around on the so-called social issues, or I would call them cultural issues, is a couple of things. Number one, the one that people talk about most often, abortion. Most people think that abortion is morally wrong, and one of the interesting things is young people are at least as likely as older people to think that. The generation that has grown up seeing sonograms is not likely to think that the baby is just a fingernail that can be clipped off without something act being morally problematic. So that issue, we're in a sort of static thing where we disfavor this activity, but we're not going to criminalize it because people have been told it's a right. We've seen a libertarian thrust on three other issues. Marijuana legalization, which we've seen voters in Colorado and Washington approve in the last election. We've seen it on same-sex marriage and gay rights issues, where there's been a huge change in public opinion in what I would argue is libertarian direction. And we've seen it on gun rights, where Bob Levy has played a huge role in getting the Supreme Court and national elites to recognize a correct, view, what I believe is, and scholars believe is a correct view of the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. In all those cases, compare us to the period of conformism, say the 1950s or something. Marijuana was illegal. Heavily, homosexual behavior was illegal. Majorities favored handgun confiscation, public opinion polls. Now we think people should be able to do what they want, but we're also struggling to figure out to what extent should society restrain some of these behaviors, which are potentially harmful associated with these freedoms, and how do we do self-restraint in the way that we have done self-restraint on issues like drunk driving and smoking. And I think those are going to be a continual struggle. We've had the president weigh in on marijuana use, which he's already written about in his autobiography. I'm not sure that was a hugely helpful thing, but we're grappling with these issues. I think perhaps helpfully that we're grappling with issues, these issues, for the most part, on a state level. You've had Colorado, Washington on the marijuana. We've had medical marijuana laws. You've had, quite a few state legislatures as well as state courts vote for same-sex marriage. Others reject it. And we can see how these things work out. And on gun rights, Florida was a pioneer allowing people to carry concealed weapon law of 1987, Governor Bob Martinez. And I remember predicting that, people were going to shoot up each other, that They didn't turn left on the green arrow. I'm going to shoot the guy, that hasn't happened. It turns out that ordinary Americans are mostly responsible people who can mostly restrain themselves, and that sometimes the learning is cumulative, and we can get even better at intelligent self-restraint as time goes on.
I should note, by the way, that previous question came from one of our students. And now we have time for one final question. I apologize to so many of you who submitted questions. We just don't have time to get to all of them. K. Can a Republican win the presidency even with so many voters receiving substantial benefits from the federal government?
Yes. Voters just don't just vote like economic calculating machines. They vote. They vote also. I think for the same reason people move in large numbers. Migrations, in my book, immigration, internal migration. They vote also to pursue dreams or avoid nightmares. People move to pursue dreams and avoid nightmares. Economic incentives play a role, but they don't automatically. I think Mitt Romney made a big mistake when he said that 47% get benefits, so they're not going to vote for me. Well, that includes recipients of Social Security old age insurance, and people over 65 voted 56% for Mitt Romney, so they voted for him. Disability insurance, we've seen a huge rise in it. I think this is tragic for many of the people who are receiving the $13,000 yearly payments because they're kind of throwing in the towel and giving up on doing what my president at American Enterprise Institute, Arthur Brooks, says is the way to achieve happiness, which is to earn success in life. And earned success can be measured by money, it can be measured by contribution to community, it can be measured by family, it can be measured by personal relationships, religious, so forth, many different ways. You're giving up on that to a considerable extent when you go on disability insurance. But the state with the highest disability insurance was West Virginia, and it voted 62% for Romney. So there's not a one-on-one relationship. Park Avenue votes heavily for the Democrats, all those rich people in Manhattan who love paying taxes and go along and swear that they will believe exactly the same things Andrew Cuomo says every New Yorker must believe. People on disability insurance are voting Republican, and they're voting their values, they're voting what they think is best for the country. They're just not just a cash register. Voting on what brought in the most money.
I want to thank Michael Barone for a provocative and informative talk. Thank you all very much.
Gosh, okay. I talked too much. Well, I don't know. Didn't get to everything.
Yeah, well.